Ms. Christie Jones, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, we have Mr. John Stroman, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Ms. Jones, you may proceed and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Christie Jones and I represent Henry Long in this appeal. Henry stood trial back in April of 2019 for the shooting death of LaKendrick Thornton. At that trial, the state presented evidence from two eyewitnesses, some expert witnesses, in addition to police officers, and most importantly, from another lay witness named Margaret Walking Eagle. Margaret Walking Eagle's testimony and subsequent impeachment was in error under well-established rules of evidence and created an unfair and reversible prejudice in Long's trial. So today I want to talk specifically about what happened with Margaret Walking Eagle's testimony. First, I want to talk about the errors that happened in her case, or in the case with Long, because of her testimony. And then I want to talk about how Long was prejudiced through these errors. So first,
Ms. Jones, if I could just interrupt for a sec. As I read your brief, I understand your issue is under the rules of evidence, inadmissible hearsay. You're not making a confrontation clause challenge. Is that correct?
Judge, I think that confrontation clause can come into play. I would say that my argument is primarily evidentiary, and I think that those are the case law cases that I rely on. I do think that there is a touch on confrontation when it comes to the way that the evidence came in under impeachment, and essentially leaving the defense attorney with no ability to cross-examine fully and effectively as the case law requires. So I don't think that I can separate those necessarily, but I would say that my argument primarily resides in evidentiary rulings.
Thank you.
So the biggest issue that I see, and I did highlight several different areas of the rules of evidence that I believe are violated with Margaret Walking Eagle's testimony in my brief. I want to start first with the issue of impeachment, because I think that that was one of the biggest errors that happened. In this case, Margaret Walking Eagle was admittedly not compliant with the state. She was not wanting to testify. She was there under a witness warrant and was not compliant with the state's questioning. In this case, the state had tried several different ways to get Margaret Walking Eagle to testify about an interview that she gave with Detective Mertes 2 days after the murder happened. However, Margaret Walking Eagle did not testify and would not testify about that interview, stating that she didn't remember, that she didn't recall. Eventually, the state, after calling her back to the stand for a second time, questioned her on specific things regarding that interview. Things like, did she know the parties? Did she know Kelsey Rubidoux? Did she know Henry Long? Did Henry Long come to her house? At this point, Margaret Walking Eagle started answering no. Accordingly, the state then sought to impeach her with all of the statements that were then in her interview with Detective Mertes. So the state then decided to call Detective Mertes to come back in and impeach her on those statements. However, before Detective Mertes was recalled, and after the state had already indicated and the court approved Detective Mertes to be recalled for impeachment, the state went back to Margaret Walking Eagle and questioned her again with short, direct statements or short, direct questions in which the state went through every single line item thing that Margaret Walking Eagle had given, or statements that Margaret Walking Eagle had given to Detective Mertes. When the state went back and went through every single detail under the guise of impeachment, the state violated what this court has said in cases like Gage and Ruffner, that the state used the impeachment as a subterfuge to get that otherwise inadmissible hearsay evidence before the jury. And Judge,
Ms. Jones, could I interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
Couple questions. So, first of all, and I don't want to pick a nit here, but I read your brief on page 8 when you said the abuse of discretion under the Gage impeachment rule generated a violation of Long's Sixth Amendment confrontation rights. So I guess I read that somewhat differently, and I thought that that was in play for us to consider. Am I right on that or am I wrong on that?
Judge, I think both. I think both are there. I think because of the abuse of discretion that happened and because of how egregious it was with that impeachment evidence coming in as that subterfuge of the hearsay evidence, I think we do run into confrontation issues, excuse me, where essentially the defense attorney was just left with no ability to fully and effectively cross-examine the witness. The witness never never adopted any of the statements. The witness never confirmed any of her statements. The evidence...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but if it's... So maybe the issue turns on whether it's actually, actually impeachment or hearsay. And I have a follow-up question, I think, once we flesh that out. But because if it's impeachment under 613... then we have a case from 2018 that says then it's not testimonial and there's no confrontation problem. That's Wills, W-I-L-L-S, from 2018. It's not in the briefs, either one, but that seems to suggest that the case is a little bit different in the way it sets up, but there is a statement there that says, hey, if this is really impeachment, it's not testimonial because it's not substantive. It's not going to prove a fact. So let's back up to where you are. When I read the record, it looked like you won on and prevailed, or the defense did, on all the hearsay, and there were three of them, arguments. And so then they went to 613, and I understand you've got this Gage-Ruffner subterfuge argument. But what I'm wondering about was that issue before the circuit court? Did someone say, hey, Judge, not only do we have a view about this violating Crawford, which was certainly in the record, not only do we have a view that this, you know, offends the rules of evidence, but in addition, we think that this is a pretext. And this is the effort of the state to do this, and they really don't mean it. Because the prosecutor at one point even said, you know, I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know she was going to testify this way. I thought she'd hold fast. And it doesn't seem like the court ever really directly confronted that or really maybe was presented with that. And if that's the case, then how are we to do that on a cold record? Decide something so, I don't know, fact-bound.
Judge, I have a couple different responses to that. I first would note, I think the state originally had stated, you know, this was something that we didn't know she was going to testify to. At first, I would say, you know, this was a witness that was called in under a witness warrant. She's not there willingly. She's not there voluntarily. So I think the state would have noticed that she could potentially be a hostile witness and not participate. Additionally, Judge, I think it's really important to look at the timeline. This was not the first time. The really egregious questions where she went line itemed and asked every single question from the interview point blank and got the denial, that happened after many rounds of trying to question her. So I call them little vignettes where she went to question her, they took a break, questioned her again, took a break, questioned her again. So I think by the time the state questioned her that fourth time, right before Detective Mertes testified, I think at that point that it would be, you know, just disingenuous for the state to say I had no idea. I think the problem was that the state knew exactly that she was going, what she was going to say, and depended on her saying that, so they could get these.
No, I understand your argument on that. My question is, though, was that presented to the trial court? Did the trial court make that determination? And if not, is that pretext or subterfuge? Is that really even preserved? And would we be relegated to plain error on that, or how would we view that?
Judge, I do think it was preserved from the standpoint of the state's attorney, or the defense attorney argued at every turn, every rule of evidence I think you could probably think of. I will also note—
But you won on the rules of evidence. I don't want to quarrel with you, but you won on the rules of evidence. Those were successful arguments, it seems to me. But the rule that you want to apply here is something, you know, there's these comments in Gage. You know, Gage gives us this four-part test, which is essentially Rule 613 with a requirement for a curative instruction. And then there's some comments in Gage that this was pretextual or a subterfuge, and we see some of that in Ruffner too. So if there's a rule that says prosecutors shouldn't use this as a pretext, isn't that a discrete issue that's different than the rule of evidence issue? Because you won on those. So this is something that's beyond that. And even though you won on those, there was still this pretext that was afoot. And was that ever brought up to the circuit court?
Judge, in looking at the record in a whole, I think the confrontation clause was definitely brought up, like you said. I do think that the record was preserved by the objections of the defense attorney. I was not the defense attorney at trial, so in my recollection of the record, whether or not the specific pretext issue was brought up, I'm not sure, but I do know that there was objections repeatedly. And I also think, Judge, that at the point that the conversations were had outside the presence of the jury, that was prior to the state's attorney going back that fourth time and line item asking Margaret Walking Eagle all those questions. So I think the defense attorney did not know necessarily that the state's attorney was going to go back and question on every single detail of Margaret Walking Eagle's interview and then call Detective Martis to do the cleanup.
Sorry, I'm muted. It's hard to know what the defense attorney might have known, but right after all those that three-part evidentiary ruling, the prosecutor said, "Okay, I'm still going to recall her." So, and she did, and that's when it all happened.
But I understand, Judge, and I will note that the defense attorney did get a standing objection for the entire testimony that Detective Martis then did come in and testify about. All of the cleanup, what I would call. So in looking at this court's case law, I think what happened here with Margaret Walking Eagle's testimony did rise to that level of what this court has talked about in Gage and in Ruffner, that this was an... Sorry, Justice Kern, I think you're muted.
Sorry, could you go to the prejudice prong of your argument, please? How was your client prejudiced by the admission of the statements admitted for impeachment purposes?
Thank you, Judge. Yes. I think from the case law indicates that when this happens, when this trial tactic is used to get the inadmissible hearsay in by impeachment, that is prejudicial. So Gage overturned, Ruffner overturned. So the case law here says that this is prejudicial error, that this is reversible error. I think even more though, the state in their brief argued that this evidence was cumulative. This was not cumulative evidence. This was evidence of a purported admission to the crime. This is the most prejudicial evidence that could ever occur in any criminal trial. So, and again, that kind of goes back to the 403 balancing test where, you know, I would argue that this was such high prejudicial evidence when compared to impeachment, which is maybe probative, but not to the level of how prejudicial this evidence is.
What impact did the limiting instructions have on the jury? We had proper limiting instructions given here.
I agree, Judge, the limiting instruction was given. However, I don't think that can atone for the overreaching of the prosecutor here. It was important for the prosecutor to get these statements before the jury. And in an effort to do so, she went back and repeatedly asked these questions and put forth evidence of a purported admission. That's extremely prejudicial evidence. And this court has stated that a curative instruction cannot atone alone for the overreaching of a prosecutor. That when this hearsay evidence is being put forth in an effort to get it before the jury, regardless of whether it's coming in substantively or for impeachment purposes, when that tactic is used, a curative instruction cannot be the cure-all. That is not enough because we have a jury that is going to be listening to this. And we're depending then on the jury to notice or even regard the really subtle distinctions between what substantive evidence is and what impeachment evidence is.
I think I understand your argument. I'm sorry. But I think I understand your argument. But can I just go at it a different way and then I'll be done. But I'm trying to figure out what it is. Because it's not hearsay. You won on those. It seems like it's not. I'm not really sure. I don't really hear your argument saying there was a gauge 613 problem in the sense that you didn't, you know, hit the marks identified in those cases. So it almost seems to me like when I hear words of subterfuge and pretext and overreaching, it's prosecutorial misconduct, right? I mean, is that your argument that this isn't really evidentiary, it's prosecutorial misconduct? Am I right?
Judge, I don't know that I'd go that far. I think that I don't need to go to that length.
Well, what is it then if it's not that? I mean, give me the rule of evidence, give me the principles. What would you call it? Is it bad evidence?
I think it's a violation of 607. I think the Gage court set that out pretty clearly, that this is not what 607 is for. And that's further emphasized in State versus Ruffner, where the court specifically stated Rule 607 of the Federal Rules of Evidence provides that you can attack the credibility of your own witness, but it's an abuse of the rule in a criminal case for the prosecution to call a witness that it knew would not give useful evidence just for the purpose of introducing otherwise inadmissible hearsay. So, Judge, I don't know that we need to rise to the level of prosecutorial misconduct. I'm confident it's probably frustrating to not get an answer from a witness at trial that you want to get. However, I do think that this is just straight up a violation of Rule 607, and I think the courts have been pretty clear about that. Engage in Ruffner, which is a rule that was adopted from the United States versus Merlang court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. So, Justice Curran, getting back to your prejudicial component, I do have to show prejudice in this case. And I think that prejudice is fairly clear from, I think I was talking about the cumulative evidence. I don't believe that this to be cumulative evidence. This was separate and distinct from any evidence that was presented. The only other evidence at trial was one eyewitness who could not identify Henry Long and did not identify him at trial. Another witness who on cross-examination had clear credibility issues. And then the state cites some other indications such as blood or cell phone evidence, none of which directly tie Long to this murder.
How about the fingerprint in the car?
Justice Curran, there was a fingerprint in the car. However, there was no indication on when that fingerprint was placed there. It was on a can that was squished up in the front passenger seat sideboard, I believe is where it was. That doesn't indicate that Long, that indicates maybe he was in the car at some point. It does not indicate that he committed a murder. So there was some other evidence that Long maybe had been around the area. No other evidence, though, of any sort of admission, any sort of weapon that had been, Margaret Walking Eagle testified that he had brought a weapon. None of that was part of any of the other testimony that had been presented at trial. So we cannot say that this is cumulative evidence. So I don't think we can find prejudice there.
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, Your Honors, in looking at this, I really think that the biggest issue that we have is these evidentiary issues. I think when you take the 607 impeachment issue and you couple that with the way Margaret Walking Eagle was originally questioned, there was a refreshing of recollection that was a violation of how the rule of 803 is supposed to be handled in court. She was asked about an interview for which she did not claim any knowledge and for which she did not ever adopt any of the statements, and she was continued to be questioned on that. We fast forward, and then we have the 607 impeachment issues. And then finally, Your Honors, the court did do a 403 balancing test, but did not give an analysis on why the admission of this impeachment evidence met that balancing test. Your Honors, I will note that 403 is a very inclusive law. It does favor the admission of relevant evidence. I would submit that the evidence as it came in as impeachment first was not relevant because Margaret Walking Eagle had yet to testify about anything of substantive value. In fact, she denied anything of substantive value. So I don't know what relevant evidence this impeachment testimony would have been. And second of all, I don't believe the probative value outweighed the prejudice here. The only probative value that would be available for impeachment evidence would be to call Margaret Walking Eagle a liar or to address her credibility. when we couple that or compare that with the extreme prejudice of a purported admission that left the defense attorney no ability to combat or question, we then see the balance tip. So even if there is some probative value to allowing this impeachment evidence, it cannot outweigh the prejudice that was caused here.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Jones. Mr. Stroman, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please court, counsel. Mr. Chief Justice, I'm going to go directly to that Confrontation Clause issue, as that was the main focus of the court. I think it's important, as Justice Salter pointed out in appellate brief, pages 7 and 8, appellant claims that the trial court committed error in allowing Walking Eagle to be questioned and then recollection refreshed and then being subject to impeachment. Then on page 8 states, quote, this abuse of discretion generated a violation of Long's Sixth Amendment confrontation right. Obviously, the standard of review regarding evidentiary rulings is that they're presumed correct under Boston. Abuse of discretion standard is applied. And if an evidentiary ruling is erroneous, must be prejudicial before the court will overturn the court's evidentiary ruling. As for Sixth Amendment confrontation right, the review is de novo. I think there's some important facts to look at in dealing with this issue. Starting on September 18, 2018, Long murdered Thornton, and then he and Rubidoux drove to Walking Eagle's house, and he had a conversation with her about the murder. 2 days later, Detective Mertes interviewed Walking Eagle on videotape, and she reiterated what defendant had told her. Approximately 5 months later, Walking Eagle was arrested on a material warrant, witness warrant in Pierre, and then brought to testify. Here's what happens at trial. Walking Eagle is called to testify and asked many questions of the sort, do you remember or do you recall? And her responses are to those, nope, she doesn't remember. Do you remember talking to Long? No. You remember talking to Mertes? No, I don't recall that. Do you think watching the video would help you? No. And so outside the jury, there's discussions about 607 impeachment on credibility. There's a discussion about Crawford. There's hearsay analysis, 804A on availability, 804B3 statements against interest, 803.5 recorded recollection, and then there's balancing done on that. Language was found more prejudicial than probative. And at that point, the state's attorney, the prosecutor, says, I apologize, Your Honor. I was not aware what Ms. Walking Eagle would testify to beyond her statements she previously made. So while they're still out of the courtroom, she views the video. She then is brought back in to testify. She says it doesn't refresh her recollection. Asked also, do you remember visiting with the defense attorney last night for an hour? Nope, she didn't remember that either. And defense does not cross-examine her at that time. It's then that the state calls Detective Mertes to testify. Talks about some cell phone tower locations, placing Rubidoux and Long both at the shooting location and at the location that the body was dumped. Defense crosses Mertes at that time. Then there's the noon recess. And the court discusses playing the video. State argues 803.5, 804B3, threats. The court, again, as Justice Salter pointed out, rules against these hearsay things, finds that there's not a proprietary pecuniary interest and safety doesn't apply. Even looks at 807 residual, says no to that. Finally, then, the state brings her back to finish her testimony and begins to ask her if she knew some people. And she starts to answer no. Do you know Kelsey Rubidoux? No, I don't. Settled record, page 43. Starts going on. Did you have a conversation with Henry Long on September 18? Answer, no. It's 46. Did Henry Long come to your house? No. Did Henry Long tell you that morning that he had shot a man? No. So now there's a conference outside the presence of the jury. State argues, we're not dealing with memory issues now. We're on 613 prior inconsistent statements as compared to what she said on video. And they want the video to be used for impeachment.
Mr. Stroman, if I could interrupt.
Yes, so, Justice.
No, it's fine. What do you think about, 607, despite it, its text doesn't go this far. The text says you can impeach your own witness. So outside of the text, our cases, or at least Gage and Ruffner, seem to suggest that there's a limitation on that. Again, it doesn't appear in the text, but our cases have seemingly said you shouldn't abuse the rule in this way. And that seems to be the centerpiece of Ms. Jones' argument. So, are we dealing with an impeachment issue here in that respect? And let's say that's the argument. Is that an evidentiary rule that's implicated, or is that some sort of bad faith? Because if it's a bad faith limitation, it doesn't really involve the application of the rules at all. Or maybe, that's a thought. Is that some sort of misconduct? Do you have to make a separate objection and say, hey, we're now at the point where this is becoming a contrived effort to get this stuff in and it abuses the rule? And if so, is that record here? Did someone say this is misconduct, or is it just a limitation that doesn't require any misconduct? I'm curious about your thoughts on it. Sort of along lines right. I talked to Ms. Jones about. Thank you.
Justice Salter, I do also carry the concern that this isn't preserved. At one point, I'm going to address here that it's very iffy if it's preserved. But the state isn't, during the trial, confronted with this issue that, hey, you're playing dirty pool. You're trying to get in unauthorized hearsay, as a pretext before the court when you can't. So as we continue on those, as it goes through and one by one, these various hearsay issues are denied. Finally, we get to a 613 issue, prior inconsistent statements. And of course, that is what the state is saying. We've got these, we may have had these, I can't remember, I don't recall. Now we're into no, no, no. We're getting answers, specific answers. There's actually on settled record in 493, there seems to be almost a deal that is struck where defense counsel, and it appears that maybe the court is entertaining portions of the video to be admitted. And defense counsel says, well, instead of the video, how about Detective Mertes can interview? And says, quote, the prosecution made short, succinct questions, and the impeachment of those questions could be short and succinct. There's almost a concession there, all right? So then the examination of Walking Eagle continues with some more no questions.
Mr. Stroman, can I ask... in that particular point in time, and I'm sorry, that's why I stopped you there, because that fourth set of questions is where I have some, it seems to me like if there was ever a question before whether the state knew what she was going to say or didn't, at that point, they clearly knew she was going to start she was denying everything. Not just, I can't remember, but no, this didn't happen. So at least at that point, where you get to the fourth set of questions, would you agree that the state knew she was going to keep saying no, or very likely knew that the rest of those questions were going to be no?
Obviously we can't answer that. And I think there's this perception of this person just being brought up and beat down and brought up and beat down. No, they're, if you look at the questions given her and the time she's up there, there's a lot of issues. And why are a lot of these issues and why is she being brought back is because she shows up having given incredible detail and now doesn't have a memory.
So then, you know, with regard to those no answers, then the other question I have, so when you apply the Rule 607 and the four-prong requirement of Gage, can you address, please, how the no answers adversely affected the state's case? And not just the fact that obviously they didn't get in evidence they wanted to get in that would have been extremely helpful to their case. But how did the no answers adversely affect the remainder of the evidence of the case? Or did it?
Okay. Justice Devaney, Justice Salter, because I didn't quite finish, I don't believe Justice Salter's. I think let me start here. Where I was coming to is much of this background and much of these issues regarding hearsay are not mattering, first of all, because the decision falls on 613, prior inconsistent statements and not hearsay. And as Justice Salter had pointed out earlier, confrontation is not involved. So Justice Curran in Richmond, just a term of months ago, stated in regard to non-hearsay, stating that the confrontation clause, quote, does not bar out-of-court statements when the statements are not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. Kahigi, this is also stated. The confrontation clause analysis is entirely inapplicable. Quote, confrontation clause is satisfied if the defendant had an opportunity to cross-examine the person repeatedly, repeating the out-of-court statements. So there now we move to Gage. Okay, so there is not a confrontation issue. And we are now dealing with a statement that was not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. Now, so when we move to Gage, this whole issue is whether this impeachment was a straw man to present to the jury inadmissible hearsay. Defendant cross-examines and in Gage, let's remember what happened. Defense is cross-examined if he told his girlfriend that he was going to commit a robbery, and he says no. So then the state, knowing what he was going to say, then knowingly calls the girlfriend on rebuttal, who they know will say, no, he didn't say that to me, all for the reason they can then call the informant who said, well, the girlfriend told me. Okay, their whole plan is that. Now, the court adopts the four requirements founded in the fundamental fairness of when using inconsistent statements for impeachment. Inconsistency, first one was inconsistency. No question. Walking Eagle's testimony is opposite of Detective Meredith's. Now, Justice Devaney, here we go with your question of coming back to relevancy. This is the big one, okay? And I think Brings Plenty helps explain this element where it says the inconsistency must relate to a matter of sufficient relevance that the prosecution's case will be adversely affected if the inconsistent statement is allowed to stand. And so that's the question. Okay, state, how are you showing that this is the situation? First of all, it has to do with credibility. Rubidoux's credibility in the trial. The testimony is she's a convicted felon. She's a druggie. She's selling meth. She had to pay for a room she had. Defendant's sole witness was to testify about her shoplifting. All right? On direct examination, Rubidoux is asked, so after you leave the area, where do you go? And she says, to Margaret's. That's Walking Eagle. And that's, you know, after dumping the body, they go there. If Walking Eagle's denial stands, then Rubidoux never came. Long never came. Significant to the credibility of the state's star witness, the one who sees the shooting and identifies the defendant, saw the murder, helped dump the body. So it's first the star witness. How else is it important, this attack of credibility on Walking Eagle? Detective Mertes. Detective Mertes's credibility also. question on 419 of the record to Detective Mertes. How did your role change in the investigation? Quote, I was placed in lead of the investigation. Okay, so Detective Mertes, well, even though there's police department, sheriff's department, all this law enforcement involved in this case, he is the lead investigator. If Walking Eagle goes unchecked, there, the defense has made a serious attack on the credibility of the entire state's case by one, a serious attack on the state's credibility of its star witness, and number two, its lead investigator.
Mr. Strowman, if that's the case, then do you have a harmless error argument? I mean, if it was so important, then maybe it was really that important. And the whole thing rises or falls on how we decide the Gage Ruffner issue.
Well, I would be of the view that it is the state has every reason to bring her. I'm not sure. I agree with Air. I'm not going to concede Air. And I think part of the reason for that to show that the state operated in good faith, that it didn't violate those three, which the third one was compliance with 613. Well, there's no question the state did that. The witness was, defense had the opportunity to explain, opportunity to interrogate, had been provided a copy of the video. And finally, there was a limiting instruction that was given before Mertes testified at instruction time, and then a third time, okay? And this limiting instruction pointed out that they were not to use this for substantive evidence. Now, what I think is important is in the settled record, 584 to 588, defense asked for mistrial after the state's argument. And they are claiming that the state was using the testimony in some substantive manner. So during closing, that, you know, the state is spending time talking about how Rubidoux is telling the truth despite being a convicted villain, druggie, etc., and her problems, and comparing it to Walking Eagle's demeanor. The court in settled record on 586 addresses the issue and says, quote, I don't read that to be Ms. Johnson was telling the jury to take Ms. Walking Eagle's testimony into consideration in determining guilt or innocence of Mr. Long, but instead was telling the jury to take her memory and testimony into consideration when determining her credibility. Never mentioned the testimony of Detective Mertes as to what Ms. Walking Eagle had told Detective Mertes.
What was significant about her credibility if she didn't give any real testimony and she kind of just shut down from the get-go and all she said was, you know, I lived over by the Mercado and that's about it. So was so significant that her testimony or her credibility had to be evaluated and scrutinized so carefully in light of this impeachment? What'd she say?
2 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I think the significance, Justice Salter, is, as I mentioned before, if her no answers, no Rubidoux didn't come to my house, no Long didn't come to my house, no to all these things, we then have a serious attack of the credibility of the state star witness and its lead investigator. And that is what I think is important in 613, why she was impeached. She wasn't brought there as a straw man because the state needed the confession. And not only that, not only does the state not concede error, but if the court would find there is error, we think it would be harmless. Because when you look at actually at Richmond, it talks about a review of the evidence, whether it's cumulative, the overall strength of the prosecution's case. What we have here is we do have an eyewitness, Kelsey Rubidoux, who saw about a foot and a half away a defendant shoot Thornton in the chest. We also have Aon, who saw the shooting. We also have the blood evidence. We have fingerprint evidence. We have cell phone evidence putting him at the location of the shooting and the location of the body being dumped. We have the doctor's testimony as to the time of death and a gunshot to the chest. So I maintain that the state did not use that as substantive evidence, and that if anything, what we're into is even 102, which talks about the whole point of the rule of evidence is to ascertain truth and securing a just determination. And I believe confronting her as to her testimony, saying none of this stuff happened, was important in fulfilling that.
Thank you, Mr. Stroman. Your time has expired. Ms. Thank Jones, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, the importance of evidence is to make sure that good and right evidence, the best evidence, is coming in before the jury. A hostile witness or a witness that is not giving the state every answer that they want does not mean that we get to violate what the rules of evidence are. I want to go back to the argument that Mr. Stroman just finished off with regarding Brings Plenty, where he stated that if we allow these statements to stand, then now we have credibility issues with both Kelsey Rubidoux and Detective Mertes. I could understand that argument had questioning stopped with Margaret Walking Eagle after that third vignette. However, when the state's attorney went back that fourth time and questioned Margaret Walking Eagle on things that didn't have to do anything with Kelsey Rubidoux's testimony, Kelsey Rubidoux, what she testified about, and about Detective Mertes, that's at that point when the state's attorney was setting up that straw man. That was no longer about questioning credibility of the witnesses. That was no longer about making sure that Kelsey Rubidoux's credibility isn't questioned and Detective Mertes's credibility isn't questioned. So I don't believe that that's what happened here. If the inconsistent statements were allowed to stand with Kelsey Rubidoux and with Detective Mertes, and that impeachment needed to happen in that narrow scope, Brings Plenty makes sense. However, the answers that were elicited on that fourth time were every single detail that Margaret Walking Eagle stated to Detective Mertes, including things that Henry had said to her or purported to say to her 2 days after the murder. So I don't think that there's any sort of credibility issue with their witnesses at that point. I also want to talk about, we had talked about whether or not this issue is preserved for appeal. As I stated before, I would submit that I do think that because of the numbers of objections that were had, because of the ways that the defense attorney did object repeatedly, that I do believe it was preserved. If this court cannot find the specific language in the record, I would submit that this is plain error. This type of trial practice, this impeachment for the purposes of getting those substantive statements in, I do believe rises to that level of significant prejudice in which we can find that there was plain error. I also kind of want to go back and talk about the state indicated that there was this deal struck. So between questioning number three and questioning number four, that the defense attorney said, we'll just call Detective Mertes. I think when we go back and we read the record, that the tenor of that conversation is a little different. As the state pointed out, at this point, the trial judge had indicated or had given every indication that he was going to let the video of the interview be played. So the defense attorney is knowing, excuse me, that in some capacity, regardless of his objection to having that video be played, that the trial judge is probably going to let that video come in. It's at that point where the defense attorney appropriately says, whoa, wait a second, that's not appropriate impeachment. If you're going to impeach a witness, you have to do it with a specific statement. You don't just get to play this video. So I don't think that there was this deal struck. that this defense attorney said, yes, just go ahead and call Detective Mertes. I think that was the defense attorney mitigating damages that he knew was probably going to happen based on the conversations that had happened with the court. Additionally, again, I think that timing is important, that conversation happened before the state's attorney went back and asked that fourth line of questions, which I do believe is so volatile of Gage versus Ruffner. Your Honors, in this case, I do believe that this was an issue where 607 was violated. I think the tenor of the rule, as this court has pointed out in many capacities or in many cases, was just abused. Impeachment evidence is not a tool to get otherwise inadmissible hearsay before a jury. That's not appropriate because we then are concerned about a jury not knowing the difference or not paying attention to the difference between impeachment and substantive evidence. And I also, based on the case law, the curative instruction alone is not sufficient to cure the defect that happened here. Margaret Walking Eagle gave an interview with Detective Mertes that she never assented to at trial. The defense attorney never had the ability to question her on it because she never assented to it. And yet the jury got before them statements regarding a purported omission from Long. This is what your case law has stated is inappropriate and is not in the spirit of the rule. So given that, Your Honors, I would submit that there was both error and prejudice in this case, and that because both error and prejudice happened, that this case should be remanded for further proceeding at the trial court level. That's all I have, Your Honors. I won't take more time if not needed.
Well, no one's ever chastised for quitting early in this court.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Since we do have a minute or two, this is not part of the formal presentation, but Ms. Jones, what did you think of this format of using Zoom?
I've never done a Supreme Court argument any other way now, so I think it's great. It works well. It's nice to be able to see everybody's faces and when they talk for it to show up for me. So,
all right. You didn't see any problems with it?
Nope. Other than the mute stuff. And other than that, I think it's pretty cool.
Hey, Mr. Stroman, what do you think?
Well, Chief Justice, I've appeared before the court in different formats. I liked it. I felt comfortable with it. And just as if I was, in the library, sorry about that, Chief.
That's the green screen. There it is.
That's the green screen. Yeah. But anyway, I appreciated the opportunity. I liked it.
All right. Well, thank you both for a good argument. We will be in recess for 10 minutes and then we'll do the next case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.